back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and Jake McClure. And the telephone numbers in here, if this is Saturday, June 13th, where you are, is 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And I've got some good news.
Oh, dear. That's going to cause our ratings to drop through the floor. Don't give good news on the air.
Yeah, but
you can just go around and do it.
In the interest of properly balanced stuff, which is an economics term.
Stuff.
Consumer spending rose 1.2% last month, and that's like...
That's 1.9, including revisions for prior months.
1.9?
Yeah.
Okay. It's
nice 2.7 from a year ago.
Yeah, and so that's a good, although not tremendous, rise.
Healthy.
It's good and healthy. It very much reflects what's going on in the rest of the economy. There's another thing that came out. Total net worth for consumers was $84.9 trillion, or six times their income.
That is now the record, absolute record wealth that the United States has ever held. And that's adjusted for inflation.
Mm-hmm. And so what we have is, that's an increase, by the way, of $1.3 trillion from the end of last year.
Oh, a trillion here and a trillion there.
So when we, and this is their net worth, this is their assets minus their liabilities. So not counting corporations. What we're talking about is the consumer net worth in the United States today is $84.9 trillion. I'm looking at 1.2% here. Headline growth for May, retail sales 1.2%.
Retail sales increased 1.2%. But the sales increased 1.9% if you look at the upward revision to prior months. The prior months they had lower, so you throw that stuff in there.
Now this is a rate of about 14% annualized.
Yep.
And that is a very, very good thing. Non-inflation adjusted retail sales growth up 4 to 5% a year is what we've seen.
By the way, at any party, if you are looking to cause everyone around you to quietly move in the other direction, mm-hmm. just read that part again. Just say that part that you just read.
Well, retail sales are rising in the 4 to 5% range on an annualized basis.
The whole room just cleared. The party is empty now.
Well, that's non-inflation adjusted.
Non-inflation adjusted. Yeah, of course. I'm going to go get to the punch bowl because my cup is empty. I've got to walk away from this.
Here's the other thing that is going to upset some of our listeners.
What's that?
The deficit dropped again.
Oh, no.
So what we had...
That's not going to upset anyone. That's going to make everyone happy.
It appears that what we're cruising along towards is a deficit in the $420-$450 billion range this year, compared with this is through the end of October.
Mm-hmm.
No, the beginning of October.
The beginning of October. Yeah, end of September.
End of September. Compared with 487 last year.
So $30 billion less. Mm-hmm. But we're still more in debt.
But this is the point. The growth in deficit as the deficit is a percentage of GDP.
Right.
Is 2.5% right now.
Uh-huh.
Now this is the gross deficit, including what we're supposed to be paying to Social Security, theoretically, including all this stuff. This includes everything.
Right.
Okay. This is not the way other countries figure it, by the way.
No, but we're different.
But we it looks to me like, it looks so far for 2015, like we're cruising along towards a position where our deficit will be 2.5%. Now, why is that a good thing? The economy generally looks like it's going to grow at 3 to 3.5% this year for the same time period. And that is different from the calendar year, by the way. I realize that we're getting a little bit esoteric. But the bottom line to it is, when the economy of the United States, the GDP of the United States, is growing faster than the deficit amount, we are effectively reducing the debt. And that is a peculiarly healthy way to do it. And we're starting
there's another piece to add in here.
Okay.
Producer price index was in May was up 0.5%. And why people are going, whoa, man, you've just emptied the room that was already empty. Over a year, so since 12 months ago, producer prices are down 1%. We have a negative price movement for a year, a 1% mm-hmm. drop in prices that people pay to manufacture or to buy equipment to use in manufacturing. That's a deflationary trend. We're just talking about growth in the GDP. We're talking about absolutely positive, massive record amount of wealth held by people. If you throw in the fact that it's actually a little over 1% larger than that, because the value that you get for the price is 1% more. Again, we're talking statistics here and the whole room just cleared out, but that concept of our wealth, our growth is doing much better than the deficit is growing. It's the deficit is growing at a slower speed than the GDP, and at the same time, we're having a deflationary trend, which means that it's really growing at a faster speed.
We're probably causing people to drool and run off the road.
That was me. That was me drooling and running off the road. But that's what I do after those long...
But what does this mean to you? It means a couple of things. First off, it means that the economy, the underlying economy of the United States, which is not growing particularly fast, it's not accelerating the way that a lot of people would like to see it accelerate
right
into the boom and bust cycle.
It's the baby boomers leaving. That's a big chunk of it.
But it is growing at a very steady, very consistent rate. Those are, I'm being redundant all over again.
Steady and consistent.
The issue is that the momentum building and that has built in the economy is still going on. We're seeing job openings rise a lot faster than hires. Now, this potentially could be inflationary down the road because we're also starting to gradually see the need to raise wages. I mean, Walmart, who would have thought Walmart? McDonald's have both raised wages. And they didn't raise wages because they said, oh my, our people are just not making enough money. No, that is not the way Walmart works. Walmart works on the fact that when they stop being able to hire enough people to keep people on the floor doing the job,
you have to raise the wages.
You got to raise wages a little bit. And they did raise wages, and they raised wages for a very simple reason. They're even having trouble finding people at the low end of the economic spectrum.
I'm going to ask people to remember, if you listened to this program a year ago, the two of us said, look ahead to June of 2015, and you should start seeing wage increases. That productivity is going to start falling off because there's only so much a few people can do, so you got to hire people. And if you're hiring people and you start hiring enough people, you have to raise wages to keep up with that, and it looked like it was going to hit right about now, and it did. The fact that we got it right isn't really because we're predictive geniuses. We just looked at the numbers, and the numbers said this is what it's going to look like. Just seems like more people should do that.
I don't know. My experience so far is that the people in the markets listen to the people in the media, and the people in the media
listen to the people in the markets.
Well, no, I think the people in the media, in most cases, having read an awful lot of articles recently, haven't got a clue what they're talking about.
Right. The people in the media go and interview the panicked trader, and the panicked trader goes home and turns on the news and watches a panicked trader being interviewed by the media.
And it scares him.
And it scares him. It's like, oh, that was me. I'm very smart. And if I was worried, then I really should be worried, shouldn't I?
Let me give you an example of the tail and the dog getting a bit mixed up here.
Right. Who's wagging which?
Anyone who's followed what's going on in the Chinese markets, the big thing is that they have had this huge run-up recently in their what they call their A-shares, which are traded on the retail markets in China. A 45% rise in the last year in their broad market. Everybody is yelling bubble. But there was a general
Sounds like something you'd hear on Sesame Street.
Yes.
Everyone yelled bubble.
And but there was a general concern about why is this happening? Is it because they're opening up new retail outlets in various places?
Nope.
And now we're beginning to get a feel for why it may have happened. This is an interesting thing. The headline was emerging markets suffer biggest weekly outflow in 7 years. Huge outflow. The Chinese market, Shanghai market, dropped 4.5%, and of course there's a panic. There's a panic that there might be a panic.
Be afraid, because someone might be afraid.
And here was the interesting reason why it dropped. Had nothing to do with news. Had nothing to do with a bunch of Chinese investors suddenly pulling their money out of the market. Had to do with the fact that the Morgan Stanley MSCI, Morgan Stanley something international, I don't remember the C, what the C stands for. Morgan Stanley, anyway, it is basically the emerging markets index.
I think it's corporate.
Corporate International.
Yeah.
Okay. So it is the emerging markets index. It's like the S&P 500 for the United States. And a decision was made last week not to include 100% of A shares from China in the MSCI. And the Chinese markets dropped 4.5%. Now, they are including a few of them right now. But here's the whole issue. It's entirely possible that the reason that the Chinese markets are up 45%, at least a big piece of that, probably half of that, is because a year ago, the MSCI board announced that they were investigating the possibility of including Chinese A shares, which they hadn't in the past, as part of the index.
This concept of an index is supposed to be a measurement tool. But there are so many investments that use the index
right.
as a way to invest that as soon as you measure something in the market with this index, then all these other people jump in and want to buy the thing that you're measuring because it's part of the measurement tool.
We need to use that number again. About a gazillion people
yes.
and funds all over the world are then required to buy the A-share stocks that are in the Chinese indexes that MSCI is using as their index.
Right, and there's another piece to
and
that.
And when they decided not to include fresh ones in there, they're already including a few. The market dropped. The Chinese market dropped 4.5%. It's an amazing. Morgan Stanley creating an index is causing huge volatility in the Chinese stock market.
Right, and the Chinese have kind of a unique scenario for outside investment. So people outside of China, when they invest into China, you can't really use dollars. You have to convert the dollar
into renminbi.
To renminbi,
which is also the yuan,
right?
Which
you,
I don't understand why they've got two names.
You can have dollar and buck and buckaroo and
I guess,
greenback
anyway,
and
whatever.
Anyway, the renminbi then is used to invest in the market. It's hard to get renminbi out of China. Extremely hard. They don't want you to take it out of China.
You have to convert them to dollars.
So you have to convert it back to dollars to get back out. And that's an issue because it's not completely free to convert from dollar to renminbi, and it's not completely free to convert from renminbi to dollar. So what you have is this almost Hotel California concept of once money gets to China, it's hard to remove it. It's still easier to remove than if you loaned money to Iceland.
that's one of those situations where if you see this massive outflow, by the way, of the $9.3 billion, which doesn't actually sound like that much to me at this point.
Well, we've been talking trillions all day.
Of the $9.3 billion that left emerging market funds last week, 7.1 came from Chinese equity funds.
There you go.
And the rest came from funds that are also invested in China, partially. So it's one of those peculiar things where Morgan Stanley's decision to not include all A shares in China in their index, which, by the way, would, on a separate subject, not, their decision to do this caused the market to fall. But one of the reasons that there's been a lot of pressure on them not to do it, anyone who follows diversified emerging markets, the standard, like I said, is the Morgan Stanley MSCI, Morgan Stanley Corporate Index, I think it is, Corporate International. The 45% of that index will be China the moment they include the A shares.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which means it will no longer be a diversified market index.
No, it's now a Chinese index.
And so, for whatever it's worth, that's one of the dangers of investing in index funds.
Yeah. Switch of subject now.
Okay.
Standard & Poor's yesterday downgraded about five major banks in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Major banks being Deutsche Bank, RBS, Barclays, Commerce Bank, and UniCredit.
Right.
They downgraded them not because the banks were in bad shape. In fact, the banks are in pretty good shape. They downgraded them because in a panic, Standard & Poor's didn't think that there was a lender of last resort. The European bank would not be able to handle the bailout, the ability to give loans to these banks so that they wouldn't go under.
Mm-hmm.
Because the European Central Bank has been so...
Well, it's very limited in what it can do.
Yeah, they have said they were going to do things that they didn't do. And when that happens, you know, the Federal Reserve, they said they're going to raise interest rates this year. They're going to raise interest rates this year because if they ever go out and they say we're going to do something and then don't do it, mm-hmm. the confidence that we have in the central bank goes away.
Yeah, I'm reasonably confident it'll be September at this point.
Right, I'm thinking it may even be August, but it's more likely that it's September because there's a press release right after the September meeting. Mm-hmm. I had said because at the end of last year they were saying June, that was before the numbers from the first quarter were as nasty as they were, so they can't really do it. Now there is a danger as well that the European Bank, the Federal Reserve, and the Bank of Japan could all start raising interest rates at exactly the same time.
I don't think if the Europeans do it, they're nuts.
Yeah, the nuts are in Europe, though. That's kind of the definition. You just defined Europe, so they're nuts.
The S&P 500 for the company also gave a warning to the United Kingdom that if they held a referendum, if they just hold the referendum on leaving the European Union,
uh-huh.
they will be downgraded. If they leave the European Union, they'll be downgraded probably two notches.
Hmm.
S&P still has United Kingdom sovereign debt at AAA rated.
Right.
Which is higher than the United States.
Yeah.
But, actually, the short-term debt in the United States is still AAA rated.
Yeah,
the long-term debt is AA rated.
Because Congress needs to get its act together
yeah.
and say they're actually going to pay the debts that they're accruing.
But the... That certainly throws a monkey wrench in the fact that Tony Blair got elected because he was appealing to the right-wingers. Not Tony Blair. Whoever it was that just got re-elected. The Tories.
My gosh. You're back. You're back two sessions
ago.
Yes,
I realize that. I can't remember the name of the Prime Minister of Great Britain off the top of my head right now. Anyway,
Cameron.
Yes. Cameron got elected. Well, actually, he doesn't get elected directly. The Tories were returned to power on the basis of we will hold a referendum for leaving the EU. And S&P said if you leave the EU, we will hit you with a downgrade which will cause your borrowing costs to jump very substantially. So.
Although I don't think it would at this point. I really don't. Yeah, I think a downgrade of British debt would be the same as a downgrade of American debt, which is everybody goes, well, there's nobody stronger out there, so
yeah.
you can't, that's just a artificial downgrade. The fact that they've downgraded American debt is just based on the uncertainty of what Congress is going to do, but it didn't affect the interest rate. It didn't affect the cheapness of borrowing that the United States is able to do. They're able to borrow at such low rates.
Well, we're going to do some commercials here.
You're listening to KTEM and the Personal Wealth Coach on this Saturday, June 13th. Telephone number's in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we'll be back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and Jake McClure on this Saturday, June 13th. And the telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. This is the last half hour of our program this week, so if you actually do want to ask us a question, now would be a good time.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people have been deeply concerned about the fact that the NSA is gradually...
The NSA has stepped in and removed all prior statements.
The NSA has been recording who called whom when.
Yep.
Now, they don't make recordings of the telephone calls and store them, but they just, all they're storing is who called who when. And there's been a tremendous amount of verbiage thrown about how terrible that is and awful. And the thing we ought to be worried about, folks, is something completely different. And we saw a tiny little piece of it emerge last week.
Right.
Apparently, the Office of Personnel Management of the United States government, and I say apparently they're acknowledging it happened. Not only was all the current information on government employees across the board
and potential government employees, anybody that's gone in for an application on a security clearance.
But they now are admitting that they got into a second
hacked. They were hacked. You haven't said that part.
Okay. The hackers who the FBI said are probably Chinese, got into a second server. Not only do they have the record, the personnel records of people who are serving in who work in the federal government, but apparently they got up to 2.3 million security applications. And this is basically anybody who has filled out one of those handy dandy forms. There's actually numbers on the forms that I have here. But basically, it's forms 85 and 86, standard form 85 and 86. Anybody who filled out standard form 85 and 86, and I know people who did that, because, for example, they had to have a security clearance because of a job they had that they weren't even working for the federal government, or because they applied for a federal job and either decided not to take it or were rejected by the federal government. Apparently, and they're not saying how far back the records that that were hacked into go, but apparently all that data, which has got to be, and I've filled those out in the past myself a long time ago, they've got to be the most extensive and intrusive document as far as finding out everything in the world about you. And it is, by the way, additionally a crime to falsify information on those things.
Mm-hmm.
Going back, we don't know how many years, apparently, and this is the best estimate right now, the Chinese now have every piece of information about everybody who's applied for a federal security clearance for a long, long time.
They're estimating 4.1 million individuals.
No, 4.1, I thought it was 2.3.
Yeah, okay. There's 2.1 current federal civilian employees and 2 million retired or former employees.
Well, and one of the things that I saw in one of the articles, and this is something that apparently nobody's confirmed yet, is it also included, because it was routed through the Office of Personnel Management, it may have included contractors.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's civilian employees and also contractors. Basically, anyone that went in to get a clearance, and if you're a contractor...
Except for the military.
Yeah, and basically what that means is that Snowden's information on himself is now held by the Chinese and the Russians.
But it's probably not too hard for the Russians to
actually. They know a lot about him. They know where he lives. They know what he ate.
But by the way, one of the things that came out of this is this information was on the server. And yes, theoretically, you had to have a password to get to it. But unlike what's on typically on your own computer, if you have any sense of security whatsoever, not only does it take a password, but if somebody gets in without the password, all they see is gobbledygook because it's encrypted. Apparently, the Office of Personnel Management determined that it wasn't necessary to encrypt
all
this
information.
Yeah. And because basically they were operating in the dark ages on this. And
right. If they just applied the same standards that they apply to corporations when they've said you must encrypt financial information, you must encrypt
personnel information,
you must encrypt HIPAA stuff. But, you know, security clearances, nobody needs to be careful about security clearances.
They're the government, and obviously the government isn't required to obey its own rules. But, you know, and another thing that those listeners, that if anybody is still listening at this point, the guy who's in charge in Congress of cybersecurity, in the House of Representatives, the chairman of the committee that handles that, is none other than John Carter. And I might suggest to you that here's an opportunity that you might have to influence the way things happen. You might go to John Carter and say, if they're going to keep sensitive information in federal data banks someplace, it should be encrypted. Why don't you sponsor a law requiring that and funding?
Yeah, I mean, it was only 2 months ago that the IRS got hacked and the Social Security Administration's been hacked, and those weren't even by governmental organizations. These were by a group of teenagers. Now we've got real governmental organizations out there that are laughing at us because we have our most sensitive information, the stuff on the information, on the information on the people that know the most important secrets that we have, and we've just given all that information away. Basically, if you don't protect it, I've said this before, this is the Wild West when it comes to cryptography, when it comes to sensitive information. If you don't have an antivirus program, you're part of the problem. If you have an antivirus program that was made in Russia, you're part of the problem.
Yes, that's Kaspersky, folks.
Yeah, you have a key that unlocks your car, and you have a key that unlocks your house. And you take sufficient care not to leave your doors unlocked and not to leave your cars unlocked and not to leave your purse sitting in plain view in an unlocked car in the Walmart parking lot. It's just you don't do that. The same is true with a computer. You need to protect your computer just the same way you would your purse, because your wallet is a virtual thing now. The fact that you can go to Amazon.com and click a button and make a purchase means that somebody hacking you could do the same thing. So it's not that difficult to get encryption. It's not that difficult to make good passwords, but you have to educate yourself to do it, and the government should have been the first ones to do this. They tell everyone else to do it.
There's another thing that Jake made me aware of as we were traveling, and so I began to pay a lot of attention to this, but it still did my investigation, and I want to reinforce something. Anytime you're traveling with your smartphone, with your computer, and you're on a public or even a semi-public
hotel Wi-Fi, Starbucks Wi-Fi, doesn't matter,
Wi-Fi, then you're in a position where literally anybody can intercept anything you send or receive. So if you decide that you're sitting in the airport and you got a layover and you got your computer, so you're going to go into your bank account and
pay some bills,
or you're going to buy a couple of things on Amazon, the only reason that somebody isn't using the information that you just transmitted against you, in place of you, is because they just weren't listening at that moment. And I went out and validated that, went to several places where people got simple programs that you can download, and went into, for example, a Starbucks coffee shop.
Yeah.
And started the program. And the guy said, the article I actually read, I thought it was pretty fascinating. I think it was in Wired. Said he started up the program, and he had to shut it off very quickly, or his hard drive would have filled up.
Yeah. Google, by accident, when they were making Google Maps, and Google Maps, you can find local area Wi-Fi hotspots. While they were making this map, while they were driving along with those cool-looking cars, they were listening to Wi-Fi traffic so that they could find unsecured networks so they could put it on the map so you would know where to go if you wanted an unsecured network. It's just a normal procedure. It's kind of cool. There's a Wi-Fi at Starbucks. There's a Wi-Fi at wherever. In the process of just recording the locations of those unsecured networks, in order to figure out that it's unsecured, the Wi-Fi has to have some communication. They have to say, are you unsecured, are you open? And in doing so, they got on the network and recorded some of that information by accident. It's easy enough to record information, traffic moving up and down, that you can do it by accident if you have a program that's just mapping Wi-Fi locations. So be very aware of that when you're paying your bills online. Make sure that you have an encrypted network that you're doing it through. And what's more, if you have an encrypted network, just know that everybody else on your network, you're not encrypted to. So if you've got a lot of people at a hotel and they say, oh, we're using an encrypted network now, but they give the password out to everybody's room, you are now on an unencrypted network even though it's encrypted. So keep that in mind. It's like, I don't know, it's like throwing money through the air and hoping that it gets where you're going when it's unsecured. It can be intercepted. People can just grab it.
Mm. So, there are ways around it. Among other things, getting a service on your telephone that creates a Wi-Fi hotspot with your own password on it. So that's expensive, relatively speaking. It's going to cost you something every month. And the other and the other thing, of course, is it may be slower, although I don't think that was necessarily true for us. It may be slower than something else. And as long as you've got a cell phone connection, the cell phone connection itself is secured. That's automatic. And there are specific laws against tapping into that. So that's a reasonably secure way to do business. And then if you have a hotspot that on your smartphone that you're using to connect your computer, and that's password protected, and
encrypted.
Interestingly enough, I have encountered recently situations where I went to log on to a hotel network, for example, and just to read the news, which obviously doesn't need to be encrypted. I'm not sending any critical information out or anything. I just want to read the news, and saw somebody's cell phone connection on there, clicked on it, and immediately got a connection. Now, right. I got off of it again, but just out of curiosity, I clicked on it, immediately got out of it again, didn't use the guy's cell phone, but whoever had set up, and it was a guy's name, that's why I say that, I recently did that, it struck me immediately.
You're a hacker now.
I didn't get any information.
You didn't have to. You hacked into the network. The fact that it was completely easy, that all you did was click on it and say connect.
No, I'm not a hacker.
And why are we talking about this? We're two economists. We just spent an hour and a half talking about dry things like unemployment and producer price index and so on. This is one of the largest threats to the security of our commerce system that's out there. The reason why it's getting as little attention as it is, as big a threat as it is, it's so localized that rarely is a hack more than just a couple of individuals or one server or one company. So there isn't really a big shield out there that covers everyone, because it's only the individuals that are being hit, which means that we've got to go to the individuals that might be hit and get them aware of what's going on. Eventually, hopefully, I can't imagine why this isn't happening faster, there will be automatic tool sets in place in the software to help you stay secure. Right now, it's like the days of the Model T, where they sell you cars that don't have keys, that you can go out and every car in the parking lot is a Model T, and you can sit in any of them and drive away. Our computers have to get to a state where security is just part of the system. It's just the way things go, and this is the concern that I have over the governmental influence. The NSA doesn't want you to. They really don't want you to encrypt your computer. In fact, one of the things that they're allowed under the Patriot Act to actually record is encrypted communication. They're not allowed to record unencrypted communication. Hackers do that. But the NSA is allowed to record encrypted information, and if they ever have a reason to look at it, then they will. So I'm encouraging everyone to go out there and encrypt because the hackers are out there. But now it means that the NSA, just because you prevented yourself from being hacked, now has the right and authority to record everything that you do in your transmissions. So there's still some big holes in the laws, and unfortunately there aren't a lot of people that really understand the underlying aspects of it. Otherwise, we would have security everywhere.
And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and we do need to do some more commercials on this Saturday, June 13th. But the telephone numbers to call in here are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we'll be back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and Jake
McClure.
And I just saw something that I think is pretty interesting, at least to me in my geeky mind, and that is Nomura Bank went out to confirm the current efficient market hypothesis crowd wave. In other words, basically there is this big argument that says active management cannot outperform indexes, which, by the way, I don't agree with that philosophy necessarily. I think there's arguments both ways, but and there's a lot of study to be done there. What Nomura found was a shock. If you eliminate from active management group all of the funds that are closet index funds that are basically acting very much like an index fund, just charging higher fees, but calling themselves active managers, you eliminate those, and you leave just the managers who are active, who actually are not trying to mimic an index, like the S&P 500 stock index or something like that, and just making minor little changes between what they're doing and what the index is doing and saying we're active management. By the way, those guys tend to lose money compared with the index because they charge much higher fees. But those managers who are picking stocks who are not following indexes generally significantly outperform the index, or at least they did from 2004 to 2014. That is just great. By the way, they also confirm some other things. The 10% of stocks that mutual funds least invested in. In other words, the 10% of stocks that were, they call it, most underweight, actually went on to have the worst performance. And that the funds with active managers, the ones they most overweighted, the ones they were most likely to buy during that period, had returns 3.7% a year above their benchmarks. Now that sounds like really geeky stuff, but it makes a tremendous amount of sense. Now, of course, you have the problem that if you want to buy a fund with an active manager and you see that and you really would like to outperform the market, how do you know that the manager is not just a closet index fund manager who's doing just a little bit of this and that in addition to it? And the answer is, that's a challenge and takes a lot of work and a lot of, I can tell you that with all my education, a master's degree backing it up, it is one significant challenge to me to get all that done correctly and to work on that. But still, the reality is there, and that makes perfectly good sense to me. By the way, for those of you who follow this esoteric little corner of things, John Bogle who has been the most outspoken advocate of indexing has been revealed a couple of times, more by accident than not, to have the majority of his money in actively managed funds.
Right, not in index funds.
And this is, it makes perfectly good another Vanguard, because he was the founder of Vanguard, but they're still, they're Vanguard actively managed funds. There's a couple of interesting things about those funds. Vanguard makes a big deal out of, if you're just going to be an index fund, we don't want you. The manager. The manager needs to actually manage, not just be an index and
right.
pretend to be a manager.
Right.
Secondly, Vanguard goes in, even with active managed funds, and has very, very low costs. So here's your here's the issue. If you have an active manager that's been around for a few years and been reasonably successful,
and doesn't cost a lot,
and has low costs, odds are that is real skill, that's not luck. And that is worth hanging on to. That's the essence that I'm pulling out of this study from Nomura Bank. It's just one study, obviously, but the issue is you got to work out who it is that's really active management, and that is really an interesting challenge in and of itself.
All right. Slight change in conversation. I have been asked several times why the Federal Reserve even needs to raise interest rates. We don't have big inflation. We're still definitely doing a recovery. We have lots of recovery that we could still do. Answer to that question. There's a couple of answers. One, we are fully recovered. The job market, if you look at retirees from the baby boom and factor that in, we're at the same level of jobs that we had before the crisis. If you look at the size of the economy, the income of the economy, all that good stuff, then you see that we are above where we were in the disaster, before the disaster started. So the economy is fully recovered. I realize it seems like it isn't, and it's been a long time, and we have a lot more to do to get back up to the growth that we should have had during the time when we had shrinkage, but we are above where we used to be. So the Federal Reserve's looking at that. That's part of what they do. And in looking at it, there is another big factor. We don't know when the next crisis is.
You don't?
No, I wish we did, but we don't. If we knew where the next crisis was, that wouldn't be the crisis that hit us. It's something that we don't know that causes the crisis. Now, we can make predictions like both of us were calling that the real estate market was way overblown, that the collateralized mortgage obligation market was really dumb. But we didn't know the size of the dumbness. I mean, the amount of dumbness out there was just staggering, and we didn't realize how much there was.
We also didn't realize how interconnected the dumbness was.
Right, and lots of people were being dumb. Smart people were being dumb. So
that's the people who are normally dumb.
We don't know when and where the next crisis will hit, but we do know that there will be another crisis at some point. And the Federal Reserve has a job of trying to get us through crisis without too much skin getting ripped off. And one of their tools is not available right now because the interest rate issue where they can lower interest rates, well, they have to have an interest rate that's high enough to lower, and we don't have that right now.
So it's all negative interest rates.
It's all quantitative easing, yeah. And it's more effective to have an interest rate that we can lower, mm-hmm. So that means we have to raise it first.
And there's some distortions in the market caused by zero interest rates. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Morning, Jeff and Jake.
Hello.
Good morning.
I suspect you guys probably read Barron's. Am I correct?
I do, yeah.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, have you read the Barron's? Let's see, the last one.
Well, I read the one that came out this morning.
Oh, no, the one that... Well,
okay, tell us what the story is.
It's about Road to Ruin. And it's Donlan's letter at the... or commentary at the back of the Barron's.
Mostly I read the news rather than the opinion, but what did he say the Road to Ruin is?
Well, what he's talking about is the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and their plans to rejuvenate them, and he seems to believe, as do I, that that would be a disaster.
Well, the problem with not rejuvenating them at this point, and I'm going to tell you this is a fact, there's a couple of things that would, each of which would drop the price of everybody's house in the United States about 25%. One is getting rid of Fannie and Freddie. And two would be a flat tax that people are advocating, or some kind of tax that gets rid of the mortgage deduction.
Right.
And if you had a 25% drop in residential property values in the United States, the number of municipal bankruptcies that would follow and the rise in property taxes that would follow would be mind-boggling.
I would say it's even bigger impact than that. Fannie and Freddie back more than 90% of the mortgage market.
Yeah.
The reason why they exist, I mean, and I'm completely in agreement with you, caller, that they are messed up, that the government set these things up with the wrong intention and then regulated private companies out of it. They got so that this, it's kind of, I'm going to make a side comparison that's easier to understand because it doesn't have interest rates associated with it. Solar power. Solar power right now is extremely expensive, and I've had people argue with me on that. They say, no, it isn't. Look, I've got an electric bill. I'm 100% solar. My electric bill is the same as somebody else's, and that's because of government subsidies. There's a massive amount of government money flowing into the solar industry that doesn't increase the quality of the technology. It just allows expensive technology to look like it's cheap. It's what the Saudis do to their oil prices when, you know, if you're buying gasoline. We're almost out of time. Fannie and Freddie are, like it or not, deep in the midst of the mortgage market, yeah. And we have to get them untangled, which means we have to have something to replace them with. If we don't rejuvenate them, we're not going to have a good market. But if we don't replace them with something and we remove them, we're going to have a horrible market.
It's rather like, by the way, a very, very strong argument was made against the FDIC back in the 1930s.
A good argument,
even. For the very same reason. The FDIC effectively is behind and owns, in essence, every bank loan. But the alternative to having the FDIC is you just can't get there from here.
Yeah, we've got to figure out a private market to replace it, a market that does not exist for mortgages. If 90% of them are backed by Fannie and Freddie, there's nothing out there that can replace 90% of the mortgage market right now.
And we really can't blame Fannie and Freddie, as a lot of people do, for the mortgage crisis in the United States, because it occurred in Europe. It occurred in spades in Spain. I like that.
Yeah.
They don't have a Fannie and Freddie. And it happened there, too. The difference is we have a much, 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 much higher home ownership rate in the United States and a more healthy economy because of it than does Europe or Japan. So without Fannie and Freddie, it's recession. If you got rid of Fannie and Freddie by any means that I can think of.
Unless it's a two-decade process of privatizing that area.
We can do it at the top of the market when our economy is roaring along.
Not in recovery.
Which nobody will want to do at that point.
Right. Because if it's not fixed, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I think Dodd and Frank both said something along those lines.
Yeah, okay.
Silliness.
All right.
Thanks for the call.
Okay, bye.
And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and we are out of time for today, June 13th. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we normally during the week have regular live people who answer the phone at 947-1111, but you're going to get a voicemail this weekend, or
toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. Until next week, this has been
Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood, the best talk in America. News Radio 1400 KTEF.